We attribute more value to complexity. Bitcoin is simple. Bitcoin works. Bitcoin doesn't need all of these other things to make it work. It doesn't need to be swapped from this token to that token and live in like an AMM that doesn't even work.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Welcome back to Because of Bitcoin. Today, we're going to talk about a very interesting topic, which is investing in Bitcoin infrastructure companies. So how do you invest in Bitcoin infrastructure companies? And what's the difference between investing in Bitcoin infrastructure and investing directly in Bitcoin? The success of Bitcoin means that every company offering services around it and participating in the ecosystem stands to benefit tremendously from Bitcoin adoption. A good example of this are Bitcoin mining companies that are already listed in the public US markets. Exchanges have also gone public, and many investors have benefited along the way. At times, they're making equal or greater returns than they would have if they had invested in the underlying asset itself. Nobody knows the world of investing in early stage Bitcoin infrastructure companies better than Bitcoin venture capital firms. And today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Nico Lechuga, founder of Ego Death Capital, where him and Andy Pitt, as well as Lynn Alden and Jeff Booth, have been doing this successfully for many years. And they just raised another fund. Let's dive into the world of Bitcoin infrastructure investing. This was a super insightful conversation, and I hope you learn as much from it as I did. And without further ado, here's my chat with Nico Lechuga. Nico, how are you, man? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Exciting times and loads to talk about. I'm really excited to talk to you about Ego Death and a bunch of the very exciting things you guys have been up to recently. But before I do that, I want to start the show as I usually do. And I want to ask you what it was like growing up in the Lechuga family, and was money or finance a big topic at the dinner table for you?
It's like a really, really interesting question. I think in doing a number of podcasts, I don't think I've gotten asked much about like background and experience with money with like my parents. So I grew up in Southern California. Dad is Mexican, mom's Italian, never lacking good food. I think he kind of merged both of the best cuisines, in my opinion. I would say that like money was not a big thought of like saving or investing or anything else. So dad's a neuropsychologist, mom is a social worker. I would say that their experience with money was largely that of most middle income like households in the United States. So they were both probably like one generation away from poverty. I think my mom was one of eight. And so you try and make money go as far as possible. My dad grew up in Carson, LA. Had a good childhood, was raised, but I think like by for all accounts, like they didn't have much money. So I think that the part of like how does that influence the next generation when we think about it? They had a conversation, I think, with their CPA. This is my dad owns his own business, mom has her own business, pretty early on, and was talking about like putting money away and excess money into equities and into their retirement. And so they just did that and paying off their house. And so it was a really, I would say, similar probably relationship with money to most like middle income households. For us, I would say like money played in a few different ways. I remember that, and not that they made a big deal of any of these things. One was going back to school, we would get a certain budget for clothing. So you get to spend like X amount of dollars on clothing. And so I remember like mentally accounting for that in my head as to like what I could or could not get. The other thing that I think like how it would play in was in these are just like childhood memories, right? Of like us going out to a restaurant or getting food and being like, this is how much you have to spend on that thing. And just like reading the menu and then I think in the back of the mind, like thinking like, well, why? Why is that the, why do I have to pick between like tacos and enchiladas? So I think that sits. I would say the other thing, like extremely grateful for my parents being a parent now, I think that the things that us as adults are concerned about, like are not what make kids happy. Money, house, cars, whatever else. I think it's like being in a loving household, being supported by your parents, being given like guidelines and principles that and people to look up to. We would take one trip a year. There's another like money thing, but I didn't realize it till I was an adult. So we take one like vacation trip a year. Grew up in Orange County in California, and not extravagant, nothing crazy, but parents when we were younger didn't have like a lot of money, but they still wanted to take this vacation for myself and my sister. And so they found this spot in Kauai. So at the time period, like Kauai was one of the islands. It was not as popular as the Big Island or as Maui. And you could get people pre-Airbnb, pre-even VRBO that would rent you their house for like hundreds of dollars for a week. And so my parents would find a house on like a random beach. They would wait till the ticket prices would like go down. They'd buy those, and we'd have one trip a year where we would go to Kauai, flying into Hawaii and then taking a hopper flight to Lihue. When we got there, another thing that you like pick up on like money as an adult is we'd make a stop. So you'd get out, and on the way out of the airport from Lihue, so this is the airport in Kauai, there's a single road that goes around the whole entire island, and there's Costco's on the road. And we would stop at Costco and we'd get food for like the week. And it never like keyed into me until I was an adult as to why. And it was like, we could have this vacation. We were borrowing someone else's house. We were renting someone else's house, and we could cook at home and we could make this work, but we could not dine out all the time. Didn't make sense. As a kid, I was just happy, like thrilled to be in like a tropical setting with my parents and my sister. But as an adult, looking back on that, I think these are key choices that like my parents had to make in order to allow us to do certain things. Now, I think that their relationship with money has changed. I think like, unfortunately, my wife sends me this stuff all the time, that us as adults or parents, we spend the early part of our lives, probably for the majority of the people, like working your ass off, and you miss this time with your kids. And then this windfall comes later on in life, whatever it is with career or success. And then you kind of relax, but you've missed those key moments. I would say that my parents were good about balancing that by having, because they worked for themselves. So it was, if there were key moments, they were there, but it also meant that like my kids see this, me doing the same thing. If I'm going to take my kid to jujitsu later on today, that means that I'm probably working later tonight when they go to sleep. So that was my relationship with it. I would say like a lot of it, like it seems like it's been in the background, and it's more of an, as an adult, you pick up on these different things. But that was like my relationship with money as a kid.
I mean, fascinating. And by the way, I have my dad's Italian and my mom's Venezuelan. So I see some similarities. And like you, I had the blessing of having great food. And those two cultures, I think, are very unique in many ways. So to kind of keep pulling on the thread of your journey and how you got to where you are, you got a Bachelor of Science at NYU, and then you went into private equity research. So at what point did you become interested in financial markets? Like, what made you want to go to New York?
I've always been fascinated with the world and like the different ways and the pieces that the world works. I think that I took a class in high school on contemporary issues, where we would have like what was going on in the world for the week. The teacher was really, really good about giving you the opposing viewpoints. Like, this is why this perceived person in your life right now, based on you having a Western viewpoint, is viewed this way. Or this is why like these things have happened. Let's give you the background to that. Let's hopefully allow you to understand that and then have a more nuanced conversation. So that went forward. Like, I didn't play too much with that with college, but when I got out of college, I got lucky enough to get this job at a small private equity firm where there were two principals. It was really more of a family office given the size and it was their money. But one of them was Ghanaian and like from Ghana, raised between like Ghana and then coming to the United States. A lot of like what they would focus on was projects in emerging and frontier markets. And so this was like my real first insight into like broken money, like real broken money. So I'll give you a particular case. We were looking at buying a Ghanaian licensed buying company for the cocoa trade. So Ghana is one of the biggest like cocoa producers in the world. And how it works is there are these licensed buying companies that buy from farmers, and then the Ghana's government, the government organization, has an agreed upon spread between what you've bought at and what you're going to sell at. And this happens twice a year. And there was, at the time period, there were less than 30 licensed buying companies. So you basically, you have a pseudo monopoly or cartel on buying this commodity. So we're looking at buying it. And in order to buy from the farmers at the time period, you had to buy using Ghanaian cedis, the like local currency. And then you exited into US dollars. And in order to do this, you had to have a currency hedge that was in place. And so there was this huge efficiency that because of the different currencies and the volatility between the Ghanaian cedis and the US dollars that were in place for like this project. And I would say like that there wasn't a one-off. Like these FX desks exist in traditional finance, not only to trade volatility on a daily basis, but they really exist to smooth out FX for multinational businesses. And that to me was so broken as to why are we losing 1-3% on this project based on like an FX spread? Like we're using one of the best trading desks in the world and we have this other thing, or this farmer on the ground just wants harder money. He does not want Ghanaian CDs. He wants dollars. But we are forced to pay him with Ghanaian CDs if you want to do this legally. So I would say that was like my it really started to like click then as to money. Or like I took a trip to South Africa. Whereas if you've been to Africa, like South Africa is like the most developed, depending on where you're at, it could be the most developed part of Africa. And at the time period, the Rand was trading at like 8-1. I think now it's like over 15-1. I mean, it's just bad money. It's bad politics, weaponization of money, and bad programs. And we were looking at different projects there, and it was just a fascinating thing of like, why me flying in from New York City to look at this project, staying here for a week, like, why do I have more purchasing power than you? Just based on this trade between my currency and your currency. I would say that was like really, really fascinating to me. But yeah, it kind of stopped there. I would say like it planted the seed in the back of my mind. I was like, oh, this is fucked up. Did you ever read Tales of an Economic Hitman?
I've read like summaries and such, but I haven't actually gone through the whole book. No.
So I read that around that time period. It says John Perkins is the guy. He's basically an economist, but he might be a spook. And he's sent around the world to write studies on if you were to inject capital into a country, like lending for them for infrastructure projects, like why that would make sense. Basically, you're just getting these emerging and frontier markets in debt way over their heads, and you control them then. So it's a soft power thing for the United States. And you're utilizing the debt to actually use US consulting companies on the ground to pay. So like, it's really just like, it's all coming back to the US and we're controlling your country. So I was like, whoa, that blew my mind. That makes complete sense. China's doing that. We were doing that. We're still doing that. It's not a Bitcoin book though. So like years ago, I came back to it, and Press and I actually got to interview John Perkins like last year.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. He had released like a new version of the book. And I was like, Preston, have you read this? And he reads it. He's like, this is fascinating. We have to get this guy on. So we get the guy on, we interview him. I think because of that interview, he was at the Vegas conference. But he's not a big Bitcoiner. But I was like, if this dude goes farther down the rabbit hole, like this is, he'd see this thing.
He doesn't know it, but he is a Bitcoiner.
I feel like that was like the first Bitcoin book. Like if someone reads that book, you're like, this should be like, before you read anything that's like Bitcoin, whatever, like this is what's happening.
I've found this common thread around people that grew up in places that have stable money, like you, and or other people that have grew up in like OECD countries, and they find Bitcoin and they get it. And it's not because their money was broken, but typically it's because they've had some type of, you know, their property rights were violated, someone in their family was debanked or unfairly treated, or they've traveled a lot. And I think you kind of fit in that other bucket because you've seen what other people's experiences are like with money. My money was so broken that I realized the best thing to do for me economically, instead of building something, was to short it. And in many weird ways, like learning to short my own fiat got me in this idea that we should short all fiat. And we short a fiat by taking a fiat loan against a hard asset. And ergo, here is Lenin, right? But this is the concept of broken money. What do I do? The answer is not a trivia. It's a huge problem, right? Like before Bitcoin, there was no real easy answer. And even today with Bitcoin, the best we can do in many cases is help people get out of broken systems, because fixing the broken systems is so difficult.
We see the same thing, because we talk to a lot of different investors all the time, period. And it's like, well, what is your experience with like money that's kind of gotten you here? I think before Bitcoin, like everybody's in real estate because they know the money's broken. The debt's going to be inflated away. And so like a lot of our investor base are former real estate investors. We had one investor in particular that he was buying a multifamily. He's buying a 400 unit apartment building. The guy's like, this is in pristine condition. It's phenomenal. And like the price is great. I'm buying it. So I turn to the guy, complete the sale. And he's like, why are you doing this? And the guy was like, well, I'm putting it all in Bitcoin. And it like, that was the chip that then this guy was not in Bitcoin, nothing else. And he's like, well, fuck, did I just make the wrong trade? And like that stuck with him, and that like got him into Bitcoin. But yeah, I think the real estate people, I think a lot of people in 2008 that were in financial markets and saw the US step in, I think that was a huge moment. I think during COVID, a lot of people that saw like 30% of their money get inflated away, I think they stepped into Bitcoin. Yeah, these are good points.
And so before we get into Ego Death and your journey there, I do have to ask you about your original business that I found out about through my research, because I'm fascinated by this, because I actually had a very similar path. I had a bunch of other businesses before Ledin. And when I saw you, I had to ask, like, you spent 6 years on Wall Street, but then you started your own business in an unrelated, non-financial part of the world or part of the house. And I really, really want to see if you could share a few words about that experience. And what have you learned about that you still carry today?
My wife and I own a company, Señor Lechuga Hot Sauce. So it's a hot sauce company. We've done collaborations with everybody from major films to video games to Joe Rogan. We've been on Hot Ones twice. I've run the business profitably since the first day. And I recouped all the money I invested in it after, I think, month four. Completely like absolved all risk. Never taken an outside dollar. It's a great family asset. I would say like I ran it with a private equity hat. This is my money. Will this program, is it profitable? A lot of like ad buying, I would say right now, is a black box and it's not profitable. And it's fine if you have a venture-backed company and you're just blowing money to create awareness. If you're utilizing like your own money for that thing and every dollar you put in, you're expecting a certain amount of return on that money, or I could put it in Bitcoin, or I could invest in the fund. And that's unacceptable to me. So like we'll turn off programs right away if they don't make monetary sense. I would say that like the parts that are really salient to me is I like love artists. And I think artists come in all shapes and sizes. So through Hot Sauce, I've gotten to do or talk to individuals like the chef de cuisine at French Laundry, who's like one of the most gifted probably chefs in the world, who the show The Bear is really based off of. We've gotten to do things with the head of culinary for Shake Shack, where you're getting to work with this person that has tried all these different flavors around the world. And like that to me is fascinating and cultivates like creativity, which I think is important in everybody's life. I think that the other side of it, like there's always a yin and a yang, right? So the negative is that food is an incredibly inefficient, antiquated industry that is run by a bunch of brokers. And so whether if you want to enter retail, you might have to have certain brokers that you pay to like pitch you into retail, which then you're going to take a spread. You're going to then have to have a distributor that's going to take a spread. Then you're going to have to do these promotions and everything else for being on the shelf, and that cuts into your spread. And so it's incredibly, I would say, inefficient in order to like how you get the product through traditional like brick and mortar to the consumer. And so we've largely pulled away from like retail and operated in a D2C environment and just not relied on other people. But I think that like, that is something that I take with me when investing in like Bitcoin companies. So we call this like multiple miracles. or well, I have a friend that calls it like multiple engines lighting, like sending a rocket to space. So I love looking at a business and investing in a business or operating a business myself where we control the success. If I make the product really, really well, if the branding's really, really well, and we're able to, like, we have 40 something thousand Instagram followers and Rogan will mention it on a podcast with like Huberman, that product should sell. I shouldn't be relying on someone to give me shelf space or a distributor to like distribute the product. And so we've controlled that. And so externally, like when I'm investing in companies or we're investing in companies, I speak for myself, it's like everybody has their own hat in the fund. The part of an external miracle happening, I think, is like extremely uncomfortable because you're reliant on something that you cannot control. I would say the other part of it too is, and we've seen this in the last 2 years, there's been a shifting of the goalposts of businesses. So historical VC 5-6 years ago was growth at all costs. Then it shifted to like growth and the you need to be profitable or some degree of profitability. How we've kind of like taken this forward is like I've run a profitable business. We invest in businesses, and how we position it to the entrepreneur is the business does not have to be profitable, but you should be able to at a certain point make it profitable if you need to, because it takes away an attack vector. If you're reliant on external capital to fund your business always, then even if your business has, in the case of food, lots of distribution, or in case of Bitcoin technology companies, lots of users, but it's cash flow negative because you've weighed it down with so many things on that business, then you're still subject to external forces that can allow your business to ultimately fail. And so that's been like, it's been good. I think on the other side of it too, it's like, you could call the fund a startup because it is. I think all these different things, like we, Andy, Jeff, myself, you invest your money, your time into something, take a risk on it. But the hot sauce too is a very much a venture, like in components of that, it allowed me to leave stability in finance and do something for myself. Now, were there sacrifices in order to do that? 100%. We ended up living in my parents-in-law house so we could invest more money in the business to like grow it. So we didn't have to take external capital. Then we stayed longer so that we could launch this other thing. Like if I have extra money at the end of the year, I'd rather buy into other businesses than utilize it to buy things. But I think that comes through when you're talking about investing to people in their companies, especially at early stage companies, and you want to see some degree of grit. How bad do you want this thing? How uncomfortable are you willing to be to get this thing? Because there's a trade-off.
Man, so many things to pull on there from, because so many things of what you said I can relate to. So number one, I wouldn't say a similar business. So I was in the paddleboard business a while back, and I had the same issue where I had to pay these retailers crazy spread so they could put me on the shelf. And the issue with paddleboards is that it was very hard to go DTC because of the shipping. And they're very fragile. And so, but the lesson I took from there, and I took many lessons from this, from my previous ventures that I still carry with me today that I think were formative to me, was this idea of if you choose the wrong distribution model, you've killed the business. Sometimes the business works, you just don't have the right distribution, or the product's great, but you're just not getting the right distribution. And there's so many things that you have to get right for a business to thrive. And you learn where the weaknesses are along the way. And the other thing I can very much relate to is your point about 5 years ago, everything was about growth, growth, growth at all costs. Profitability was out the window. And I remember, because we were all out in the market when BlockFi and Celsius and these other groups were trying to raise. And all they did was balloon their assets on platform with garbage assets that made no money. But nobody was looking at what was in the asset mix. Nobody was looking at cash flows. Everybody said, oh, how many assets on platform? That's great. Your valuation is a multiple of assets on platform. And I think that was a huge mistake that led, unfortunately, to many losses for clients and people and investors. But at what point let's get into the Bitcoin side of the house. At what point does Bitcoin come into your life? And when did you decide to start, I guess, ego death? Let's answer Bitcoin first, and then we can get into how you guys came together.
So the first time that Bitcoin came into my life was actually, I was working at the PE fund, and I remember that there was a Vice News article. So like Vice, when it used to be like this hardcore publication out of like Brooklyn, New York, you get this magazine. The magazine, even before the HBO like 30-minute documentary that they would have on a weekly basis, like the reporters were hard. They would, okay, great, the US is engaged in Afghanistan. Like, we're going to send someone to like embed with the Taliban and like interview the other side. Okay, there's a cartel issue. We're going to like send someone to go live with the cartel members. So it was like fascinating pieces. And one of the pieces was on Bitcoin, but in the most vice way possible. So it was on the Silk Road and the Armory. And so the Silk Road was, as we all know, like a place to buy drugs. But the Armory like was more interesting to me in the fact of like you could buy supposedly weapons, like whatever weapons you wanted, and they would be shipped to your home and you were using this magic internet money. I talked to Peter Todd about like 6 to 8 months ago, and he was like, I'm not convinced that the Armory was ever like a real thing. Like if it ever, like, but it was good enough for the article. And I think at the time period, I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is the thing that you have to use to be able to do that. How do I get that? And there was too much friction at the time period. And it was really a novelty, like in my mind. I would say like fast forward, it really becomes something that like clicks and makes sense. Jeff Booth and I met at a conference for Summit Series. It's this entrepreneur conference. And we're sitting down and he's talking about the inflationary nature of the world and our monetary systems and how technology is deflationary. And he has these two opposing thoughts that are in his mind. He's going to put them down on paper and write a book for his kids. We end up becoming like pretty good friends. I get an advanced copy of the book, read the book. And there's one paragraph in the entire book. I would put this like right. If John Perkins' book is a Bitcoin book and it's not a Bitcoin book, like The Price of Tomorrow isn't a Bitcoin book, but it has a Bitcoin component in the book, right? But everybody keys in on that one paragraph. This might be the thing. It's not even hard on the conclusion yet. Jeff and I met at the Ace Hotel afterwards, and I was like pinging him with questions. What about this? How you view this? What was your preconceived notion on that? We talked through it, and at that point, it clicks. And it probably clicks because of like the private equity background, looking at this other money, like, okay, great. That makes sense to me. And now he can't go back. And I remember being like, okay, so how much of your portfolio is in this thing? Great. That's what I need to put in this thing. But it's not sexy. Like, right? It's Bitcoin is the safest, potentially most boring investment that you can make. And I like investing in like companies and other things. So portfolio allocation, great. We buy Bitcoin. Makes sense in my mind. So COVID happens. Andy Pitt and I might be the luckiest person in Summit. Andy Pitt and I get put in like a small group through this thing called Summit Series. You're meeting once a week to have like some semblance of human contact at the beginning of COVID. Her background is in principal funding and investments, so structured finance at Goldman Sachs. With this very, very unique team. She's also worked like throughout the world and traveled the entire world. And I'm still keeping this like comms channel open with Jeff. I'm seeing billions of dollars be raised for like alt crypto projects. So we have this thing, this boring asset, Bitcoin, right? SegWit and Taproot happen. And at that point, it like clicks. Ah, there's something here that I'm highly interested in. So I put Jeff and Andy together and come to the conclusion of, I think there's an investable opportunity on top of here. What everybody else believes and has poured billions and billions of dollars into of being like secure, decentralized, scalable is not the case. And we have this thing that is secure and is decentralized and now can scale. And there will be projects that will be built on top of this thing. And there are other investors in this space, but I think we could do something different by having a very, very specific investment niche. So if you think about the time period when we came into Bitcoin, the hype in Bitcoin at the time period, and this is because there wasn't a lot to invest in, it was really on mining and people were agnostic to like round size. People are investing, like the hottest thing was we're investing in mining companies. I was like, we're not going to invest in mining companies. We're not going to invest in anything that is hardware-based, doesn't scale well. We're going to invest in software. The software is going to be built and constructed on top of Bitcoin. It'll scale faster. Your margins will get better as the products have more success and it's much easier to have network effects. And we're like, we're going to be really, really specific as to the stage too. So we're going to be a seed stage fund. We're going to be a seed stage fund because of the principals, backgrounds in entrepreneurship and investing. We can lead these transactions. We can come in the room. We can get the companies to where they need to be. We can get them in the right shape so that they can go out and raise later rounds. And that's what we did. So we raised initially $25 million. We augmented it with decent size, like an $8 million SPV, and ended up like totaling 33 total. I like the number 33. I'm not sure why, but we went out, we led every round that we did minus Wolf. Like Wolf never had a real lead based on just how the investment is structured. But even then, we're on the investment committee for Wolf. What we realized though was the companies were maturing. They were getting bigger. They were having more success. And like you run a very successful Bitcoin company. If you were to be like, what would a historical like Series A would look like? You'd say, okay, it's $1 million in revenue. You could raise a Series A. That shifted a bit, like with the downturn of the market of like, okay, we want 1.5. And then the band for like a Series B was really 5 to 10. The starting of like, hey, this company can raise a B. What we were seeing is that companies in the Bitcoin space were generating $5+ million in revenue. Some of them were profitable. And they were having trouble raising A's. And so there's this huge valuation compression in the space. The companies now no longer like have the degree of risk that you perceive. The company is, if we go back to the beginning thing, like build a business that's resilient to external forces, a business that is profitable, as long as the customers don't dissolve, like isn't going to fail. And so we have these businesses that are now are generating the beginning of a revenue band of a Series B, but they're valuing them below where like historical Series A's were. They have less risk.
And why do you think that is? Like, why do you think that? Because it presumably the same issue wasn't being faced. And I remember at least this was true way back. I mean, if you told the investors that you were asset agnostic and that you were going to list any crypto asset under the sun, it gave you like this, it was like what was expected. When we, and I remember this because when we came to even raise and have conversations with people, we said, we are Bitcoin only. We're building for Bitcoin. We're building, and yes, we'll support stable coins, but we're building for Bitcoin. And people thought that was, they called us the boring Canadians. Okay. Like that was what most people called us, not just like, or endearingly, I would say. And look at how that played out. Right. So, but why do you think it, are you still seeing some of that today? And if so, why, or what are the reasoning that these people give you as to why they're happy paying crazy valuations on garbage, presumably that supports other tokens versus they just can't get their head around it's Bitcoin and Bitcoin only?
There are two reasons and they both have different, three reasons. They both have like, and they all have different reasons. So one is investors by nature that have extremely high IQs do not like things if they're simple. There's us as human beings.
Great answer.
we attribute more value to complexity. Bitcoin is simple. Bitcoin works. Bitcoin doesn't need all of these other things to make it work. It doesn't need to be swapped from this token to that token and live in like an AMM that doesn't even work. Those things though are intellectually interesting. The white papers are intellectually interesting. They are academic. So I think there's a whole host of like, I have friends that have spun out of like your biggest funds. They do other things in other spaces. And I could tell you meetings like that happened 4 years ago in those particular funds. And they challenged, in principle, it's on the Midas list. I don't think that what you want to invest in is where we should be investing the money. I think the easiest bet to do is just like in Bitcoin. Place the money in Bitcoin. It's boring. It's a lot.
Did you get fired? Did you get fired? Did you get fired?
Didn't believe you. But I know other people that are still at that particular fund. This is a massive fund. Massive fund. And the person that runs a lot of capital for the fund right now is a big Bitcoiner. The principal is not. I would say like now there are projects. Like I just talked to somebody at a pretty decent sized fund, crypto fund. And I was like, here are two projects that we're investing in right now. They're like, make the intro. Love to make the intro. I think it's changing. I think it's going to take more success. So let's get to the second point. So like, okay, we've established that there's less intellectual complexity here, probably, right? The second point is I think that alt crypto with tokens broke venture capital. I've said this a few times. Like, so historically, venture capital was based on this thing called the power law. One in 11 of your investments is going to really, really work and the rest are going to fail. Like 2 to 3 additional are going to do okay. And then everything else is going to go to zero longer term. That one investment though is like, where does the term moonshot project come from? It's like you wanted to put something on the moon. And the chance of you doing that and the complexity for you to be able to do that, one, it takes a lot of capital. It takes a lot of time and patience. And if it pays off, it's going to pay off by like, I just planted a flag like on the moon. Tokens broke that. So historically, VCs were like, I'm going to place capital today. And my expectation is I don't get a dollar back for 6 to 9 years. Because that was the time period to get liquidity. Now it even takes longer. But 6 to 9 years. What happened with the tokens was it changed the incentive for the VCs. So these funds that were in the past, like they would pay to keep the lights on and the salaries and whatever else based on the management fee. And then their real big payday was if the businesses were successful, they get the carried interest on the fund. Well, the tokens now, so you had this valuation thing, they didn't give a shit about the valuations. They wanted the token warrants. We get the token warrants and now we're going to look at how the tokens are locked up. And even in projects, and I've talked to other massive VCs in the crypto space, even in projects that are no longer like really used, the token's not going to tread to zero. It's not going to go to zero. And the based on the exercise price that the VC has, the VC is going to make money on all those projects.
FTT comes to mind.
Yeah. And all of those projects too, and the token lockup ends up looking like over a 24 or 12 month. You might have it. I've seen some with like a 6 month lockup, meaning like you get it today. Can you think of 6 months into like your company? Company's probably not even like in market, but suddenly there's this token trading on it. And the VC every like 6 months gets to unlock these tokens and sell them into the market. They don't care about the company's success. All they're looking at is getting the carried interest on this. So I think that like historically that broke venture capital. I think that a lot of the VCs are realizing that right now. And that like, so from day one with EDC, we have token blockers in the deal. We lead a deal, you cannot list a token. You cannot have an underlying token in one of our portfolio companies. Now,
oh man.
Or we have to consent to it. So like the belief is like what you're seeing right now is like they're going to be tokenized securities. And our belief is that there is a friction. Like we talk about brokers in like food, there are brokers in finance. Tokenized securities for the right size equities, publicly traded companies make sense. That makes sense. You need to be able to have the free exchange of the shares. It does not make sense for an early stage company. So if we're going to do that, one, the environment has to exist. Okay, the environment exists and the company is big enough, the company could probably list a token then. But the token is the same thing as like a share.
A share. Man, you guys, I think get the Bitcoin space so well just by the things that you've mentioned. And I remember like some of the first questions we got asked when we were going around and raising our A's and our B's was, hey, when are you guys listing a token? When token? Are you listing a token? And have you considered a token? And we just kept saying, we don't need a token. Like, why do we need a token? And it was like pulling teeth. But eventually we got to the people that saw the vision and understood it. And we have some great backers. And by the way, I have massive love and appreciation for all the investors that have supported Ledin to date. Not everyone is like this, just to say it, right? Like we're talking to you right now, who is like completely built for Bitcoiners. And I love what I'm hearing. I'm sure any founder or person working at a Bitcoin company is listening to this, nodding their head. And I want to talk a little bit about the success of EgoDeath, of the company itself. You guys deployed into some of the best Bitcoin companies in the space. Your first fund, you guys just raised a new massive $100 million fund now. Congratulations on that. Can you tell us a little bit about like how has that investor base shifted from the people you raised the first money into the second? Are these people doubling down? And it seems also that you've changed the target size investment for this new fund to kind of now take advantage of some of this valuation gaps that you're seeing between Bitcoin companies that are not necessarily getting from the market what you think they should be getting. And so can you talk to us a little bit about that evolution?
Yeah. So these are great questions. I'll like take them one by one. And the best thing, I think one of the things that you and I talked about beforehand was the question that we get asked all the time, and founders probably get asked all the time in the space of, why do I invest in this versus Bitcoin?
Yes.
Why do I invest in this company versus Bitcoin? What we end up like talking to them about is, we believe that this is one of the only spaces that can exceed on a long-term horizon Bitcoin's rate of return. And the reason behind that is, what happens if one of these companies is successful? You have a high growth tech company that's basically strapped to a Bitcoin miner. Take something like LN Markets. LN Markets trades profitably on all of their trades for themselves, and they have tons of users. And as the cash flow of that company is Bitcoin. And they can keep that as like a treasury asset. So you have this future value of like Bitcoin that you can like come into as a present value. And the market doesn't really understand that right now. But I think like when the market does understand that, those businesses will be valued like high, as we think in like Bitcoin terms. So that's like one of the components. I think the other component, when we think about like Bitcoin, venture capital, and portfolio construction, this is not a binary thing. In the same way, if you're constructing a portfolio and you have like your long Bitcoin, then you could think of this as your private equity or venture capital component. As some people have now Bitcoin equities, or you have MicroStrategy, maybe treasury companies and whatever. You now have a little bit more of an asset mix. That is like how you size it, in our opinion, appropriately, and now you're looking at like exceeding that. I think the other part is like, if you're going to invest in these companies, it requires a lot of intelligence, not from like how smart are you on from like a test standpoint, but intelligence meaning like the information that is fed back to the fund. So like I would personally invest in VC funds that are able to garner superior intelligence that I myself cannot. They can make correct investment decisions, understand what the space is going to be in this particular space, understand what the open source developers are working on, how does this integrate with traditional finance, do the traditional financial partners want to work with them? And that's our investment approach. Now, is it a risk? It is a high risk investment. We think we're in the best companies, but like time will tell. The investor base, this is like one of the most exciting things for me. 95% of our investors are first generation money. Like first generation, like they have made their own money. Now, when you think about that, at first it's shocking. And then you think for a second of like, okay, well, they're pretty damn deep in Bitcoin if they're investing in a Bitcoin fund and invest in Bitcoin technology companies. So this type of human though is like, I made this money. It's valuable to me. How do I not make sure it doesn't get inflated away or taken from me? Which is why they came to Bitcoin. Now they go further down the rabbit hole and they're like, oh shit, there are companies that are in this space. And if I believe that this space is going to be big on a long-term time horizon, me placing a small amount of my like wealth in this is a phenomenal hedge. So that's how they come into it. So we're not even selling like the slides that are like, why Bitcoin that you see in every single deck. I would say like, if we're explaining that to you, you're not going to invest. I know probably within 3 minutes, if like someone was going to place capital, probably quicker. That becomes like an important piece. I would say for like anybody building in this space, it is not enough to be superior to like other Bitcoin companies or to sell to just Bitcoin companies. Whatever you're doing and whatever you're solving has to be superior to anything else that exists in like the technology space in the world. It has to be not only like 5% or 50% or 100%, it should be 10 times that. You need an order of magnitude because the switching cost is so high. We need to have like Bitcoin at the foundation of everything. You need that order of magnitude. And then even if you have the order of magnitude, if there's no moat between you and anybody else, and the moat can come from a technology place, it can come from how sticky the product is, it can come from like the entrepreneur's executional like aptitude, but there needs to be some type of moat where someone can't just switch this thing on and take everything that you've built. Then it becomes really intriguing. I would say the other part for us is all of us coming from an entrepreneurship background and building like businesses that cash flow. The business has to have some way that it makes money in the near term future. So historically, like and before this token craze and us investing in crazy businesses that are like whiteboard businesses, you base the rounds on every 18 months. Company raises seed, 18 months later, they're raising a Series A. So in that 18-month time period, if everything went well in that company, the company should be generating a minimum $1 million. So the first question that you're asking every single company is, how are you getting there? 18 months after that, how are you getting to 5? 18 months after that, how are we getting to 10? And if we can't answer those questions, or the market's too small or something from there, like, it's probably not a good time to place the investment. The worst thing from an investment thesis, in my opinion, is like to be right on the investment and wrong on the timing. But if you can answer all those things and back into it with a degree of confidence, like, build the project. It's really exciting.
And to give some people some more color around some of the stories and the people, like, what are some of the most exciting deals that you've done? Like, maybe your most favorite deal, or maybe one or two investments that you've made. And then I want to ask you what you're excited about going forward for this new fund. But I first want to hear from you, like, what's been your favorite sort of investment experience, or at least favorite once you've invested, just the journey and to watch them grow? Like, do you have any one of those that you hold dear?
I would say, like, all the deals are pretty interesting from the standpoint. I really like, how do you find alpha? So to me, it's really exciting to invest in things that are incredibly, we're not cheap internally, right? Like, we're not saying, like, who else is on this cap table that we can back into? Like, we become high conviction on a bet. We place a decent amount of capital into a company. We'll place $1 to $7 million into a company, and we back it based on, like, our own thesis of, like, how we gonna think it's gonna play out. I think, like, seeing that still asymmetric opportunity and, like, briefing some of the world's, like, best VCs, and, like, it taking a bit to click, I would say, like, that's, like, incredibly exciting. I think that some of the things that are being developed in emerging and frontier markets, I think that, like, historically, right, in venture capital, you would have VC funds, and they would, I'm a New York fund, I'm a San Francisco fund, I only invest in San Francisco companies, I only invest in New York companies, I only invest in US companies. Well, Bitcoin's a global protocol. Bitcoin's open to everybody. What you end up finding is, like, in these other areas, there are very special entrepreneurs that are able to innovate in a way and tap a world market. Other investors don't understand that. You're uncomfortable with that. Those, if you thought that the US companies had value compression, like, those companies have even more. And that I'm really, like, excited about. Now, at a certain point, it has to click for other people, because you're going to need bigger buckets of capital to come in. I would say, though, that even with, like, where we're at from a standpoint of traditional finance or company adoption, like, some of the backroom conversations that we've been privy to over the last few years, like, give me incredible excitement that there's a lot more to, like, come in the space. I think I'm never excited by short-term price action, and more so, like, long-term results.
And do you find that, given you have such a broad, like, I'm, you made a really interesting point. I just want to ask you a follow-on that one, because on your point about we're a San Francisco fund, we're a New York fund, we're this fund, presumably back in the day, you would say that because you would have these companies with a nearby office, and then you could go check out and keep an eye on them, a closer eye on them. Nowadays, with remote work and just how nasty traffic in their cities has become and how sprawled out everything's become, I don't necessarily think that actually holds. But I guess the point I wanted to ask you was, did you find that you have to adapt your model, or is it more challenging to work with founders in different time zones or different countries, or how do you tackle that one?
This is where it becomes, like, really beneficial. We have 5 general partners, and the partners travel a lot. There's generally going to be someone that's, we're going to cross that. I think it was when I saw you at Vegas, Lynn and I were at Vegas, and he was at the Oslo Freedom Forum. And then Preston was at, like, Bitcoin Korea.
Right.
I mean, we have, like, just by splitting up the organization, you have the ability to touch so many different individuals. I think with the VC fund thing, I think maybe while it's spread out a bit of, like, I don't necessarily need a San Francisco company, it still is, like, I need a US company.
Yep.
If I were to be like, I talked to one of the bigger US VC funds that deploys billions of dollars of capital. We have this really interesting Brazilian company. One of the principals at the fund is from Latin America. And we need a US nexus. Can't look. So that still exists. And it still exists. Like, I would say, like, that particular fund, while it's very large, is on, like, the bleeding edge of, like, venture capital, in my opinion. And I think that if you want to, like, Tiger made a killing of this, because the original, like, founders of the fund would travel around the world, travel around the world, they'd find these projects. There was compression with the projects. They'd fund them. By the time the world picked up and those became like successful projects, they did very, very well. And so did the founders. So I think like taking this viewpoint is key. Also too, from like our investor base standpoint, like we have global investors. So they're, I would say, open to it. But you still need that touch point. Like, and we get the touch point because the Bitcoin events, I'm very, very lucky of like the people that I get to work with. Like they are at a lot of these events. We normally have someone, we have a touch point with the company. We're going to meet with the founder in person before like we invest in the company. Yeah. The world's very flat, I would say, like reaching to different places.
I think it makes a ton of sense for your strategy because like you said, and we were just talking about this, I find that people in emerging markets get Bitcoin faster because they have to, and they have even more of a need to adopt these services that are being built. And the more you can get to the actual founders building for those end users and the ones that get them the best. Listen, those are the products that Americans don't know they're going to need yet, but they're all going to need it because fiat is all going in that direction. And what are, as we're coming up on the, at the tail end, but I did want to ask you, what are some of the areas, perhaps not like direct names of companies, et cetera, but like, what are some of the things that excite you about the Bitcoin ecosystem in the next, call it 1 to 5 years?
The space that you're in is huge. Like, whether designed that way or whatever else, I think we've gotten to a place of adoption where people want to be able to do something with their Bitcoin. And that something isn't like locking it into a DeFi protocol, right? They want to live their life. And they want to live their life in the same way that you could with a decent equity portfolio back in the day. Like, I could go to a private bank, I could pledge 30% of the house down payment. Like, there's this huge thing in Bitcoin right now, like, don't buy a house. You don't need to buy a house. Just buy more Bitcoin. But if you were able to buy the house and not give up your Bitcoin, but just like give custody to the other party, like there's still going to be people in Bitcoin that have an issue with that. But I would argue it's much better than you buy $1 million house, you give $300,000 of Bitcoin custody to X, Y, and Z private bank. The house is now yours because the lender has collateralized the Bitcoin and the house that you've just purchased, right? And even if Bitcoin's price drops a bit, like there's not a crazy like margin call like you'd have on some of these other loan platforms. It's like, hey, we have an existing relationship with you. There's a phone call. Can you service this thing? End of the day, your house is paid off. The Bitcoin, the appreciation on that $300,000 is given back to you. So you get the house and you get the Bitcoin. I think that like now, right now in the US, because of different regulations, like that's not quite possible yet. There's no big lender that's doing that. You really need someone with a huge amount of capital in the back. Because if that was a trade, like if Ledin offered that tomorrow, you become like probably the biggest mortgage company in the United States.
We did have a Bitcoin mortgage product out in the market in 2021. The challenge with mortgages is that the institutional world for financing, so whenever you originate mortgages or any type of loan, typically the structure is you have a warehouse and then you sell off the book to an institutional group, right? The challenge with the blended collateral mix is that there still is no vehicle in the public markets that you can effectively post-warehouse roll that into, right? Because we can take multiple $100 million Bitcoin-backed loan parts of the book to different banks and partners that we already work with. And they'll take it. They know how to work with it. They price it. It's they know how to manage it. This idea of having two different types of collateral going in to secure the book is still not there by way of just getting people or getting the public markets comfortable. But that is something that, you know, we're very, very interested in.
My private bank will offer me that with like an equity portfolio.
Yes. No, and listen, like because they're offering you two products. At the end of the day, they're offering you the equity-backed loan to do the down payment, but they're still underwriting a traditional mortgage on the other side, right? And so they're selling off the two things separately. The challenge with the model against the Bitcoiners, and this again, I'll say this because I think about this a lot, okay? The mortgage, to underwrite a mortgage, you have to go through this very intrusive process of your servicing costs. So if I wanted to issue you, like the way our Bitcoin product was built back then was you gave me $1 million of Bitcoin, you want to buy $1 million house, we'll give you the dollars to buy to close on the house, right? It's all a giant Bitcoin-backed loan, right? And that takes the house as the collateral. And the reason for that is that in order for you to be able to sell off a mortgage from your books into this offload public market vehicle, it has to have the same, it has to tick the same boxes that the bank's mortgages do. So for example, what's the debt servicing capacity? What's the income? What's the, show me your three last tax statements. Show me your SIN number, your SSN. And we don't ask for any of those things at Ledin, because in fact, a lot of our clients that are Bitcoin rich and Bitcoin retired or self-employed or founders, they don't have these beautiful looking cash flows with their T4s that will make them qualify.
I completely get what you're saying. Like, I think it makes sense, but like, think of it just like this. And I explained this to the guy that runs like the biggest credit unions in the United States. And he was like, should I be implementing X, Y, and Z? And I was like, that's defensive. You have the financial capacity to like step out on like the curve and offer new products to grow your deposit base. And I think getting to your point though, is like, there is on the back end of this. So like me as the consumer, it's going to look like I pledge. So I don't want, like right now, everything is over collateralized. Like it's like in this case of yours, it's 1-to-1. I want the same thing that I could do with an equity portfolio. And here's the other side of it though, is you talk about all the people, and this is where I think that a lot of like the space is looking of like, okay, what do the biggest like Bitcoiners look like today? Okay, they don't have like the traditional financial statements that we'd have for these other companies. I actually think what would happen is you would grow more people in Bitcoin, because you'd be like, this is a new way for you to buy a home. Instead of you putting 20% down, dude, just buy 30% of it in Bitcoin, go to this lender, you're going to give it to them. That thing is going to cost like X amount less by the time you're done with this loan, because the Bitcoin will have grown. But we're not having this thing where it's like, I want to buy a $1 million home and like, I need to pledge $2 million of collateral.
Yeah.
Or I need to pledge $1 million of collateral. That's like, it's untenable for so many people. And I think that like, I'm really excited about your space. I think like, because you guys are so far out, you're going to get to like make some of these products. And I think it's growing the depositor base, like new Bitcoiners, new people that are looking at this of like, well, why would I ever buy a home any other way? Let me go out and buy the Bitcoin. And then you have a new customer. Like, that's cool. I think you'd start it too. Like, you could do it with cars initially, right? You're going to have like personal, like two biggest purchases, right? That people are making. And all is better than anybody else. It's like cars, houses, forget college. Like, college is to the side.
These are things that we actively discuss internally, because those are the biggest use cases for our products today. Like, what the biggest use cases for Ledin products today are down payments and purchases of real estate. And beyond that is starting businesses or funding Bitcoin cash flows, like Bitcoin companies that have Bitcoin treasuries that have payroll and they don't want to sell. And then the third one is like these sort of big capital investments. So I'm buying a car for myself. I'm buying a rental property that I want to buy as an investment. So these are all, and really, like, if you look at Ledin, like, we're all obsessed about, if we see somebody using a loan for a particular use case and it happens again and again and again, we productize that into the loan one click. Instead of you making four clicks or five clicks, this is how B2X came to be. B2X is a loan that helps you buy more Bitcoin with one click, because we saw people were just coming out taking Bitcoin back loans and taking the proceeds to buy more Bitcoin and came back to do the same thing. And so we wrapped it on a bow, and the same thing we did with the mortgage. But I think we did the mortgage, again, just if I'm being recalling the time, and I think the issue with that was we did it right at the bottom or right at the beginning of a rate hike cycle. And we started out in Canada, where the real estate market was just not, it didn't hold up that great. And people were having more concerns, ironically, during that time. People were more worried about their house appraisals than they were about the Bitcoin. And so it was just an interesting time in the world. But I think, to your point, the world might be ready for some more Bitcoin loan innovation and blended collateral.
I think too, like, you'll have the opportunity to, so like, you're gonna cross the Rubicon, right? Like, so many people are like, I'm gonna solve this from a Bitcoin standpoint. Like, you guys do very, very well. But in the sea of traditional financial companies, like, you're a dot. And the access to the amount of capital that they have, like, it's gonna require a partnership. You're going to have to say, like, we are partnering with this. We've secured the back of this thing that can probably like securitize, productize this thing, sell it out in the market. And also too, we have access to just like pools of capital. Cause like, if this is in my opinion, like we'll see, I don't know. If this was solved in the right way, I think you become like the biggest mortgage provider in the United States. Like, I don't think it's like, I don't even think it's close.
This is something that we've already tried. And a lot of us at Ledin come from real estate background. To your point, a lot of Bitcoiners do, because it was just the hard asset that was more easily financeable. And we just kind of got how that dynamic was very beneficial in an inflationary world. I will keep you on top of our potential product pipelines. And now I'm going to ping you separately just to run a few other things by you, because I love your vantage point.
I will buy the first home through your platform. If like that's
you heard it here first. Man, thank you so much for taking the time to do this today. Where can people learn more about EgoDeath and yourself?
If you go to egodeath.capital, you can go there. We have a blog. You can subscribe to that. We put out like quarterly call reports on that. We're on Twitter at EgoDeathCapital. And you can find me at Nico_Lechuga. Yeah, look forward to interacting with all of you at hopefully a future Bitcoin conference.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on, man. And I look forward to chatting with you and seeing what you guys are up to with this new fund.
Thanks, Mauricio.
I really enjoyed that chat. And who better to invest in founders than a founder himself? I love EgoDeath's approach to investing because they understand founders and they also understand Bitcoin. Nico's insights from his own entrepreneurial ventures can help him assess opportunities, and his learnings can also help him be a great asset to his portfolio company founders when they themselves need to navigate business opportunities and challenges. The success of their first fund and their recent raise for their second fund cements the idea that Bitcoin venture capital is here to stay. I am incredibly excited for EgoDeath and its portfolio companies, and I would not be surprised if we start seeing more and more Bitcoin companies IPO into the public markets in the years to come. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledin.io. That's ledin.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.